fellowship, and let's continue on here dealing as we are with, again, potential objections which may be posed that flow off of this matter of God's judgment, his just dealings with sin, and particularly his wrath. As he says now, as he continues on here, since our unrighteousness, as he says in verse 5, demonstrates the righteousness of God, God can't be unrighteous when he inflicts wrath, can he? And the answer, of course, is no, he can't be. So therefore, any objection off of this that sin shouldn't be judged or won't be judged is wrong, even if one makes the argument that my sin, my unrighteousness, glorifies God. It helps him, makes him come across better even, because it throws his attributes of righteousness and justice into sharper relief. And he said, well, no, I can't go that way. As he says, may it never be. Otherwise, how will God judge the world? And again, the Jewish mentality was that God was not only going to judge the world, they were looking forward to it. Because, again, of their misplaced confidence in their racial heritage through Abraham and in their possession of the Mosaic Law, and neither of which saves. Now, Paul continues on here in verse 7 with his thoughts. Now, if through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I still being judged? The only thing I've changed here to make it more plain what he's saying is like a Gentile sinner. The idea of sinner here is almost a term to suggest the Gentiles, because that's who they really thought were going to be judged. And that's who they thought the judgment was largely going to fall on. Now, if you probably pinned a Jew down and said, well, do you believe that God will judge everyone fairly? He probably would have said yes, but he probably would have had some caveats. Yes, with the understanding that his judgment will be different for the seed of Abraham than it will for the rest of the world. No, it won't. That's Paul's whole point through here. It's not. And essentially, Paul takes the Jew who believed he had the moral high ground, who sits up here judging his Gentile counterpart, who is very much less oriented to the truth, not as squared away, doesn't have the revelation that the Jews had in the Mosaic Law and other factors. And he essentially pulls him down from his perch and levels the playing field for everybody. But look, God's going to judge everybody equally. It doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile. You think you've got this advantage over the Gentiles, but the fact is God still judges Jews too. And Paul points that out here, that why am I, as he says here in verse 7, why am I still being judged like a Gentile sinner? If that's the case, if the Jews have some up with God, and secondarily, if my failure, my sinfulness somehow glorifies God, then why does God even bother judging me? What, that's another corollary off of this, is why bother? Well, now is a conjunction duh here. But if, or now if. If is again a conjunction I, EI, which introduces a first class condition. But now if the truth of God, the truth is aletheia, A-L-E-T-H-E-I-A, with the genitive of theos. Again, a genitive here. Again, righteousness or truth that God either possesses or produces, depending upon how one wants to look at it. One could see it as a genitive of origin, that the truth that originates with God, however you want to classify this genitive here. But the idea is the truth of God, the truth that God advocates. Through or means. What you've got here is in with the instrumental of the possessive pronoun. By means of me, emos is the pronoun. Of my, and then the word here is susma. P-S-E-U-S-M-A. Again, the mos suffix is acting. This is a word for a lying or a lie. One time it's used falsehood, untruthfulness, or lying. If through my lying, literally, not just a singular lie, but the fact that I lie regularly, that people lie regularly, if through my lying, the truth of God abounded. Here is our main verb, perisuo, P-E-R-I-S-S-E-U-O. This word means to exceed, to be in abundance, to abound. If through my lie the truth of God is excessive or is abundantly clear into His glory. And then you got into here, directional preposition, eis, into with a doxa, the word for glory or reputation. Here the idea is the glorification, literally, of Him. Again, an objective genitive here on this pronoun, God receives the glory. Why, interrogative adjective here, tis, why yet or still, and they've translated as still, you've got the adverb eti, why still even I, or I even is the way they've translated here, you've got this cross as kago, which is a compound of chi and ego, even me, or even I. Why, still, even I, as a sinner, as or like, conjunction here, host sets up a comparison, and then hamartalos. H-A-M-A-R-T-O-L-O-S. Hamartalos means exactly that. Comes from the root, hamartano, to sin. Hamartalos is a sinner, a wrongdoer, one who misses the mark. Why am I being judged? Present passive indicative of krino. K-R-I-N-O. Now the important thing here is Paul does not talk about the judgment here as being future. The present indicative of krino indicates that this judgment, whatever, however God judges sin, is going on right now. He's not looking to the final judgment, as he has been through most of this. When you deal with it, generally speaking, he's been looking to the final judgment. Now through this section here, he talks more about the present. That our unrighteousness demonstrates the unrighteousness of God now. And God inflicts wrath now. Although, again, it's, at some point, we know down the road, there's no question, that you're eventually going to have that major judgment on all sin. But for now, God deals with sins now. We're not waiting for Him to deal with sins. He deals with sins as He goes. And why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and as some claim that we say, let us do good that evil may come. Their condemnation is just. And here is a chi here. And not say, actually, what you, not just as we are slandered, and some affirm that we say, but you have to supply an interrogative here of some sort. Like why? The why is not actually here in the Greek. Why am I being judged as like a Gentile sinner? And why not say, and not, again, say, you supply some verb of communicating here. It's not literally in the Greek, but it's understood. Just as. Kathos, even as, accordingly. Kathos is stronger than hos. It means exactly as. And as exactly as, we are slandered. We are being slandered, literally, blasphemeo. B-L-A-S-H, blas, P-L-A-S-P-H, rather, E-M-E-O. And just as we are being slandered, they've translated here like it's an adverb, slanderously reported, but there is no verb here. And just as, again another kathos, just as some phemi is our verb here, P-H-E-M-I. This verb means, comes from pho, the word to give light. We got our word phos, phosphorus, comes from that. But phemi means to make plain, to bring to light, to assert, to affirm. And as some claim, some assert, some is the pronoun here, tis, which functions as a subject of the verb. Some assert us to say, that we say. What you have here is you've got this construction where the infinitive lego, they assert us to say, is actually a construction for indirect discourse. And then the us, ego here, actually is an accusative, but it's an accusative of general reference. It functions as the subject of the infinitive to say. In other words, some claim we say that, and then Hadi here introduces the content of what Paul is claimed to have said, claimed to have taught, and that Hadi here is just reflected with the quotation marks. Let us do evil, so that good may come. You got here a subjunctive, aorist active subjunctive of poieo, the simple verb to do, P-O-I-E-O. It's a first-person plural. This is what we call a hortatory subjunctive, so it's essentially a first-person command. Let us do, or we must do, is the idea. It's a first-person, it's a command, but a command in the first person has to have this helper, let. Let us do evil things, kakos, bad things. Definite article. Also, to kakos, the accusative neuter plural, the evil things. In order that, or a purpose here, you got hina, which introduces a purpose clause, H-I-N-A. In order that, the good things. The nominative neuter plural, good things, agathos, A-G-A-T-H-O-S. Let us do the bad things so that good things may come. Or may result, aorist indicative, or aorist subjunctive, I'm sorry, rather, of erkomai, to come or to result. So let us do bad things so that good things will happen. Well, that's a weird view, and how anyone would accuse Paul of teaching this is almost beyond me. They obviously have not looked. But again, when people are negative and when they're hostile, the truth doesn't get in their way. It doesn't even slow them down most of the time. And it certainly doesn't stop them. They will assert all manner of things about you and your teaching that aren't even, in many cases, aren't even close. And here, it's not even close. They slandered Paul, claiming, of course, if the law is of no value, and if the law doesn't save us, then obedience to the law doesn't matter. Therefore, we might as well sin, and let's just do bad things, because God's going to bless all this, because he's glorified by it. Well, that's not Paul's doctrine. That's what he's accused of teaching, but that's not his doctrine. So let us do the bad things, so the good things will come. Or evil things, as they've translated. They've translated them here as collective singulars. I get it, but they are plurals in the Greek. Of whom of the people that are saying this, the ones who are blaspheming Paul, you got a present passive up there, a blasphemeo, but it doesn't provide you a discrete subject of who's doing the slandering, the blaspheming, the maligning. Here we have of whom, of those who malign like this, of those who slanderously attack us, of whom the judgment, to crema, definite article, plus the noun there. And this means a judgment, a decision of a judge. And in this context, as you can see, the New American Standard has rendered this in an interpretive way because they understand the judgment to be one of condemnation. And so they understand what Paul's getting at here and rightly reflect judgment as condemnation. Their judgment is just, but judgment will be the judgment God pronounces on them and condemns them for their viewpoint. Is keeps on being present indicative of I me, and dikos, E-N-D-I-K-O-S. Two times this is used literally in the right. You've got dikos or dk, the root, which means that which is right or fair, and then in. So in righteousness, we might say, or in justice. Their condemnation is deserved. It's just, it's fair. And they get what they got coming for advocating this stupid viewpoint. And at some points, that's all you can do is leave it, as Paul does here. leave your enemies with God, and then recognize, okay, I see what stupid stuff they're doing. I'm aware of it. I know what kind of things they're maligning us with out here. I know the types of things that have been passed off as the truth. Just leave it with them, and when God judges them, that'll just be great. Then we'll just take a little pleasure in that. Well, as much pleasure as you can rightly take in it. One of the things you're warned about as a believer is in the Proverbs is not getting too high and mighty when your enemies get judged. Not to get too excited and thrilled, lest God change your mind and back off on them. He doesn't like his children to get overly excited when the dirty dogs get it that deserve it. But there's that part of you. That just like, that's why the Bronson movies and the Clint Eastwood movies and all of that were always so popular. The getting even movies, as I like to call them. I love them. And everybody, and most people did. They always cheered at the end of the movie. I mean, when the bad guy get it in the neck, everybody, you know, or like the Muppets, they're all happy, you know. Those, you know, the Charles Bronson movies, I really like those, you know, because they were all, you know. We can't make movies like that no more, because they're not politically correct. Well, the bad guy gets it in those movies. That's what's not politically correct. Can't have that. So now, back to this. If through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory, and it did, why am I still being judged like a Gentile sinner? And why not, as we are slanderously reported and as some claim that we say, why not say, let us do evil so that good may come? Their condemnation is just. All right, point one, these final two verses have created a good deal of controversy in regard to the thought process of Paul. Some see verse 7 as a restatement of the objection in verse 5, while others take it as a continuation of the question at the end of verse 6. Certainly, if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, it's pretty much parallel to through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory. They're similar thoughts. And so you can see why one would immediately say, well, this is a restatement of what is said in verse 5. About our righteousness, or God's ability to inflict wrath on that righteousness, and his rightness in inflicting wrath on our unrighteousness. So, one reason for the differing views is that some texts have the conjunction gar, for or because, in place of the conjunction duh. The latter here, the duh, which is what we have in ours, being the preferred reading. So three, it is more consistent with Paul's argument and with the actual construction in the Greek text to understand verse 7 as a reiteration of the question in verse 5. Four, both are found in the form of a first class condition, and both clearly have the same emphasis, even though slightly different language is used. The question at the beginning of verse 5 about our unrighteousness, God's judgment, and his ability to be righteous, or God being glorified through our unrighteousness. Well, that's essentially what he says. If through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory, then why am I still getting judged? Is God right in judging? Can he be right in judging? Well, five, the reason the question is reintroduced is that Paul digressed slightly in 5b and 6 as he began to answer his own question. And he now returns to his initial thought at the beginning of verse 5. And when he says, what shall we say? Well, he goes on from there in verses 5b and 6 to answer that. But then he gets right back, I think, pretty clearly here. Reiterates, obviously it's different wording, but the similar idea of what he said at the beginning of verse 5 with what he says here. 6, in fact, through this section, there has been a contrast between God and the Jews. Although some have argued that Paul is referring to mankind in general, which is seen in the differing terms that are applied to each. A verse 3 contrasts the unbelief / unfaithfulness of Israel with the faithfulness of God. The Greek terms apisteo and apostia are contrasted with pistis, the faithfulness or loyalty of God. B verse 4 uses different vocabulary but makes the contrast. The term aletheis, true or truthful, is contrasted, when used of God, of course, is contrasted with soustes, the lie. And again, I have take that to be in verse 4, every man be found a liar. His emphasis is on the Jews. But again, this will, by extension, this is one of the things you need to see in this too. Because when Paul deals with the Mosaic law as a way, I mean, he has dealt with the fact that the Jews possessed it, and they looked at it as a vehicle to salvation. What he says of the Mosaic law, in context, most often refers only to the Mosaic law. But there are a couple of places where Paul kind of broadens his spectrum. And we might say, sort of law in general, any kind of law, any sort of moral standard, a code of conduct by which you are going to demand, define, and then demand righteousness, compliance with it. That the Mosaic law as a perfect legal system couldn't save. It had the revelation of God contained within it. Well, what do you think is true of here out of these other standards of law that exist, these moral codes that men have had? Are they going to be able to save? And the answer is no. And so while the emphasis here is on the law through a lot of this, it does expand to deal with other forms of law. Well, in most cases in here too, his emphasis has been on the Jew. But what, as we're going to find out, is true of the Jew can also be broadened to include other men as well. That other people lie. It's not just that the Jews were the only ones that lied. That's certainly not going to be our doctrine. So he talks about in verse 4, may God be found true, though every man a liar. And in verse 5 tells you he's still talking and focusing primarily, I think, on the Jews when he says, if our unrighteousness. That he classifies himself still as among his people, the Jews, in that sense. Well, see here, verse 5 contrasts the adikia, unrighteousness or wrongdoing of the Jews, with the dikaiosune, the righteousness of God. And verse 7 contrasts the susma, lying or the action of lying, with the aletheia, the truth or truthfulness of God. So you've got these contrasts here that are designed to set up. And of course, the negative type term is always applied to the Jews. Well, 7, each of these terms provides some additional nuance to the failure of the Jews, as well as providing a necessary contrast between the faithfulness, righteousness, and veracity of God. So 8, each of these terms represents some failure on the part of the Jews, which has been acknowledged as something that enhances God's glory. The darkness of sin serves to provide greater relief to the light and the glory of God. In one sense, truly, in order to fully understand God, one fully has to kind of grasp the nature of sin. That God is seen in contrast, part of God's very essence and his function, his method of operation, his modus operandi, the way he functions in life is seen only because of sin. If there was no sin, we wouldn't know how much God hates sin. So sin, as this fall of Satan, why did God allow all this? Well, when one really gets into it, there are some complex doctrinal truths and wisdom in what God did and why. And first, we could know a lot about God if there was no sin. We could know certain things about him, that's for sure. The fact that he commanded Adam and Eve not to sin, that would tell us, even if they didn't sin, we would say, well, he must have some aversion to sin. We don't know what it is. We wouldn't fully understand it because we wouldn't see sin and how destructive it actually is. And so when people deal with God, they look at him and they say, well, okay, here's God. What's he like? Well, certain things we would never understand if it weren't for the fall. For instance, one thing that's not a part of God's essence technically, but certainly is a part of the way he functions towards the human race, is the matter of grace. We wouldn't understand grace if there was no fall. And so you have this necessity in some ways of evil in the world. But all the evil does is enhances God's glory and shows him up to be exactly what he is, opposed to all evil, fully righteous and just at all times. So again, the darkness of sin, this provides greater relief. Well, then surely God would be happy, right? No, he hates sin. Sin never has any intrigue for him at all. And it doesn't, in one sense, sure, he is glorified as he judges it, in that he's proven righteous and just and consistent and all of that. But is God ever happy about judging people? And it seems to me, and that I remember, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Seems like that's in Ezekiel, if I remember right. I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. So God's not, it's not as though he's up there thinking, well, I'm just really glad because the more they sin, the more I can judge them. This really shows how good I am and how bad they are. He's not that way at all. He doesn't care for this. So 9, as with verse 5, verse 7 is introduced in a first class condition, which is presumed as being true. 10, Paul switches here to a rhetorical singular, my lie, to include himself among those that have failed to believe and to be loyal to God's plan, which is the current status of the Jews at large. That's just the way it is. Paul chooses to identify himself with his people. Now, he's a believer, though. They're not in many cases. But he still, racially, he's a Jew, and he acknowledges this, and he doesn't seem to try to distance himself from his Jewishness. In fact, again, he says here in verse 5, if our unrighteousness, but verse 7, he makes it more specific, if my lie, as that he's talking about. Well, 11 here, the truth of God refers to his faithfulness and righteousness in judging sin. God is glorified in all this since his word condemns sin in the first place. And he judges it just as his faithfulness, as his righteousness and his justice demand. And 12, the glory of God abounding has to do with the fact that God is vindicated in his actions in judging man and upholding his word. So God is seen, as it were, to be greater and greater and greater. The more man falls short, the greater it's seen that God is this great, awesome being that one cannot effectively approach, in fact. That he's beyond all this. So, 13 here, Paul then follows the first class condition, which forms the prodesis of a conditional sentence, with an apodosis that is phrased in the form of a rhetorical question. So, if through my lie, the truth of God abounded to his glory, and it did. This is presumed as true. Now, here's this question, which serves as the apodosis of the rhetorical, or of the conditional clause. Why am I still being judged just like a Gentile sinner? It's 14, the important thing to understand with regard to this question is that Paul is asking it from the standpoint of a Jew whose unbelief / unfaithfulness has actually enhanced the glory and reputation of God. Now, again, what Paul talks about here in a limited way, focusing on the Jews, is true of men at large. All men have sinned, all fall short, all get judged. God's glorified in all of this. But Paul's focusing specifically here, again, in the first four verses of this chapter, he seems to be addressing a potential Gentile train of thought, whereas in the next four, verses 5 through 8, he seems to be addressing a Jewish mindset. And that's important to keep before you because that kind of makes some distinction as to what he's doing here. Well, 15, thus he asks the question as to why would God judge him? Even though he is a Jew, one of God's chosen, in the same fashion he judges other sinners. 16, the adverb eti, yet or still, is translated, I believe, still in the New American Standard. Why am I still, even still, yeah, still, is used to express the logical inference that one could make from the apodosis. The idea is, what further need does God have to judge me, since my failure highlights his glory? And again, we've seen that this question leads to nowhere. You can ask it if God's glorified in sinning, then why not sin a lot? Or alternately, then why not we just deny God the right to judge? Well, guess what? You can't do either. Those are conclusions one might reach, but they are not going to stand the test of time or the test of doctrine. So 17, the emphasis here is on the fact that the Jews believed they would receive preferential treatment in the judgment. And the Gentiles would generally be condemned. 18, the term hamartalos, I don't know what happened there, but, I think I do know what happened. It looks like the breathing sign is wrong, but that's okay. I'll have to correct that one. The term hamartalos, wrongdoer or sinner, is to be understood as a reference to the Gentiles, as seen in a similar use in Galatians. Galatians 2:5. And Galatians precedes Romans, so this is one reason, too, when you cite a usage, you should say, well, you know, did he use this before or after this usage? That's one thing. It's chronology matters when these books were written. And this one was written probably in the early 50s, whereas Romans was written at about 57, as we've documented. So here, Galatians 2:15, we are Jews by nature, and not sinners from among the Gentiles. So sinners here was just a kind of a loose term. This was a loose term they used to apply to Gentiles and even to the, quote, they deemed the irreverent people of the land, the tax collectors and the sinners. And it encompassed a broad manner, a broad number of people. It was designed to be, you know, pejorative. It wasn't a nice term, you know, when they called them all sinners. But here, he specifically applies it to their view of the Gentiles, because this was a term that the Jews used of the Gentiles. Again, they used it sometimes even of their own, but more often than not, they used it of Gentiles. Well, 19, what is clear is that Paul presents his objection from a Jewish perspective, which would be used as an argument to reject Paul's gospel, since it condemned Jews and Gentiles alike. So 20, Paul has advanced the proposition that the Jews in their unbelief have actually advanced the plan of God, as seen in his righteous judgment on them. So if one takes this to its logical conclusion, then God should reward people for sin and unbelief. Okay, well, I don't think we can go there. I just don't think that's going to fit with our theology long term. It doesn't fit with the essence of God. It doesn't fit with what's revealed in God's word. And again, while people could logically advance to this spot in their thinking, then you have God becoming a rewarder of what's wrong rather than a judge of it. And that's just not going to happen. God's never revealed himself to be anything other than a judge of what's wrong. He is a rewarder of the righteous, but now we're talking about the opposite deal of rewarding sin and unbelief. Well, he's not going to do that. That's pretty clear. So 21, as will become evident in verse 8, that is precisely what some of the Jews had accused Paul of advocating. If sin and unbelief bring glory to God, then one should certainly engage in those things as much as possible. And 22, verse 8 is notoriously difficult from a grammatical and syntactical standpoint. But the difficulties are best resolved by translating the sentence in the fashion the New American Standard has. This translation is also consistent with several other translations. One of the nice things nowadays, of course, for many years, you really couldn't have it, but because of the technology and the electronic nature of the media, I can look at 20 different Bible translations in 2 seconds. And so I can look at how Christians have translated this, the Reformed, out of the Revised Version. How they've translated. I can look at how some Jewish people have translated it. So it's nice. You can look at it and say, okay, well, is there any major thing here? Has somebody introduced something into this translation that's unique or that brings out something better of the grammar? Well, no, they haven't. This one's pretty close to what's being said here, although, again, it's not a precise word-for-word literal translation. It's not meant to be, as he says. So why not say, and again, part of the difficulties is you have to supply some things in here. You have to supply a question, why, and as they have done, although they didn't put it in italics to let you know they've supplied it. They've just supplied it back from the previous use of this, why am I still being judged as a sinner? And because of the chi here, connective, you can rightly supply and why, because it governs the thought of the next sentence as well, or the next question. But you also have to supply some verb of communication, and why not say? There's no verb of communication here. So there's a couple of difficulties, but they're pretty readily resolved, and they're not that hard from a, quote, strictly Greek standpoint. So here, let's see where we are here. Again, if this verse 8 is notoriously grammatical, but again, the translation here is consistent. So I don't see anything that's gained here really by materially changing the sentence. Or at least translating it differently. We're not changing it, but translating it differently. Well, 23, however, some of the difficulty is removed. If one takes verse 8 as a continuation of the question that was initially posed in 5b, what shall we say then? And why not say, this would be an answer to that, what shall we say? When he asks that question, God is not unrighteous. And then go to the verse 8, and why not say, why not advocate this other position out here? So 24, the sense of it is that one can take the position that Paul has taken in verses 5c through 7. Or he can take the fallacious position that sin and unbelief is a good thing that should be rewarded. Well, one can argue that point, but one's never going to win that argument as long as God's alive and as long as he's judging sin. He has revealed himself to be absolutely opposed to this. Well, 25, Paul's detractors, the some, as he alludes to them, as some claim that we say, had accused him of taking the second position, when in fact he makes his positions clear in the previous verses. And the Jews would likely have agreed with his position in these previous verses that, hey, we can't take this position that God's unrighteous when he judges. We can't have a God that's unrighteous. And so I think your average Jew, while he might not like where Paul's leading with all of this, would have had to agree with a big section of it. Would have had to agree. Now, he might not have liked some of those things said in chapter 2 and might not have agreed with them at all. The Gentiles are going to be treated like Jews. That, they would have probably carped that and buckled that and bristled that. But this deal of we can't accuse God of being unrighteous, the Jew would have to say, yeah, no, we can't. We really can't. Well, hey, God, one cannot effectively charge God with being unrighteous for judging sin. That's why he says I'm speaking in human terms, because I'm pointing out that this is fallacious and you should know that I don't advocate this viewpoint. B, God can and will judge the world as per the many Old Testament prophecies. Romans 3:6, for otherwise, how will God judge the world? 1 Samuel 2:10. And again, pretty standard theology for the Jews. They understood this pretty well. This wasn't really debatable. They weren't confused on this matter theologically about the coming judgment. Those who contend with the Lord will be shattered, and against them he will thunder in the heavens, and the Lord will judge the ends of the earth, and he will give strength to his king and will exalt the horn of his anointed. But at the end, again, it's a kind of universal thought in Judaism that God's the judge of all men and that he's going to judge all of this. 1 Chronicles, next one, 16:33. And again, the Jews, to some extent, were somewhat looking forward to this because they really felt like they were on the right side of this deal. And so therefore, the judgment to them was not going to be a bad deal as far as they were concerned, or at least it wasn't supposed to be. Verse 32, let the sea roar and all it contains, let the field exult and all that is in it, then the trees of the forest will sing for joy before the Lord, for he is coming to judge the earth. Psalm 96, 10 and 13. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. And then again, this is a repeat of what we just read. The Lord is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness. 98:9. Let the mountains sing before the Lord, for he is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with equity. And 135:14. Again, pretty straightforward stuff here that was pretty well understood. This wasn't a big issue with the Jews. They would have accepted all this. But here's the way their view of it was. This kind of sums up their view. For the Lord will judge his people, and he will have compassion on his servants. Oh, we're his servants. We're the Jews. And so when he judges us, we're going to get compassion. Gentiles, not so much. They're horrible sinners, and they're pagans, and they deserve to die, and that'll all be fine and good with us. But we Jews, we're going to have something different. Well, see, human sinfulness, while it may enhance the glory of God, should and will still be judged. You can't get away from the fact that God's going to judge sin. No matter how you look at it, no matter how you try to twist it, no matter, God, it's really in your best interest that I sin. God's not buying what you're selling. He cannot smell what the rock is cooking. And the fact is, people are never going to convince God, if that was their view, well, let's convince God to kind of look the other way. Because, he's making out okay in this. He's not being hurt by my sin, is he? But of course, that's another whole issue. How does sin impact God? That's not going to be addressed here, and we're not going to deviate on that now. But one might have to ask the question, how exactly does sin impact God? And unbelief and unfaithfulness. Because, we treat God, we apply to him, human emotions anthropopathically, to ascribe things to him that he doesn't really feel. But, God is said to feel regret. He's said to feel pain. He's said to be upset when his people aren't loyal. He expresses jealousy, which is a pretty strong emotion. And so I would say that my reading of the scriptures and looking at the various anthropopathic ways that it's spoken of is that God hates sin and that it doesn't do him any good. And in fact, it destroys his creation and mars it. So that there's nothing good about sin. And people can argue, sin glorifies God. Sure, it does. Everything glorifies God if you look at it from the right standpoint. But does that mean that God's for it? And the answer, of course, is no, he's not. Well, 26, while there are a number of ways that verse 8 can be punctuated, the thing that must be understood is that Paul is acknowledging the fact that his detractors had imputed theological positions to him that were contrary to what he taught. And 27, while Paul and other adjusted communicators have never advanced such nonsense, the reality is that those who are negative and hostile are more than willing to impute such false inferences to those that teach the truth. You got different kinds of people out here that you have to deal with. One kind of person doesn't care about God and his plan. They're not interested. And they're content just to leave it alone and let it go. And they're content just to be nice about it and move down the road and don't care. There are other people, the truth just bugs them. And they can't just let it go. They've got to involve themselves somehow in undermining the truth. Again, you have people who might be exposed, say your average Gentile out here, to the revelation of creation. He's exposed to it. But then there's that segment of them that suppress that truth, that actively work to suppress the truth of God in physical creation. And that person is very much different than the person that just doesn't know or isn't concerned or doesn't bother themselves with it. And so you have these sort of hostile people who, when they crash and burn, they're not content just to crash and burn. They want to drag everybody with them they can. And so they go out and they impute these fallacious viewpoints to Paul. Paul's teaching this, they'll pull him aside. Has anybody talked to you about Paul? We're a little concerned. And so they'll phrase it in such ways as to make it seem like they're on the right side of this deal. all the while undermining the truth. That's what they're doing. But they don't come up to you and say, hey, I'm a horrible enemy of God and I'd like to destroy you. Can we talk? Most normal believers would say, get off my porch. You know? So the fact is, there are people like that, though. They just, they're not content just to die on the vine, as it were. They've got to drag other people down with them. They've got to attack the truth. They're not content just to let it go. And in many cases, today, nowadays especially, in many cases today, you've got people attacking the truth who couldn't exegete one verse to save their freaking life. They couldn't exegete one verse of the Bible, and yet they're clear on all the theology. Really? Well, then I've been wasting my time. I mean, all I need to do is study under them. I could just sit there and absorb their monstrous information. The great amounts of it that they have theologically from all their exegetical work. Oh, wait a minute, they haven't done one verse. They couldn't exegete a verse to save their lives, and yet they're experts on the scripture. There are so many of these self-appointed experts out there on the internet that it is just sickening. I mean, to even look around and see the people, oh, I don't go to a local church, I'm a law to myself, but I got all my theology worked out. You're a jackass. First, the fact that you're not in a local church tells me you're a jackass. Because the fundamental principle that I see overriding all the epistles of the New Testament is the local church. Again, when one goes back and considers it, and we're working on that right now in systematic theology, ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church. And when one goes back and considers the New Testament references, the references to the local church outnumber the references to the universal church about 95-5. What does this tell us? Just from the sheer weight of the numbers, what does it tell us? It tells us something about the emphasis of what the deal is. So people don't sit under face-to-face teaching, which they're commanded to do. Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together, as the habit of some is. They don't submit to authority, which they're commanded to do. They don't really learn the Bible, because even when they do assemble in many of these churches, all they're getting is the 3 points, the poem, and the prayer, and then 17 verses of Just As I Am. And so they don't get it, but yet they've got all the theology figured out. And they can't figure out the most fundamental thing of what they're supposed to be doing. I say these people are idiots. I say they've completely missed the boat. And so if we're supposed to all the more, as we see the day approaching, isn't that the command? Then we better get with it. This business of we're going to cut back, we're going to tool back. No. It's not what the scriptures teach. Not that I see. And so you get into the book of Revelation, you have these seven what? Local churches. You got seven pastors in their hand, the stars, in the hand of Jesus Christ. And he addresses, all he says in the book of Revelation goes to what? Local churches. And the letters in the New Testament. How many of them are written to what? Oh, local churches. And guess what the letters who aren't written to local churches are written to? Very often, they're pastors or pastor candidates. They're somewhere in the line of authority in the ministry. They're troubleshooters for Paul, or they're pastors like Timothy was. 1 and 2 Timothy are written to a pastor. 1 or 2 John there, and 3 John was written to an individual believer about what to do if the pastor became abusive. And there was this particular pastor, this Diotrephes, who had lost his mind doctrinally, apparently. And this can happen. You know, you can have pastors go off the deep end, get into all manner of junk. And this guy apparently had. And so John writes to this believer and says, well, you know, the believer's like, what am I supposed to do? My pastor's gone nuts. And he said, well, get with so-and-so. He has a good report. He's reported well among those in the truth. And even on some of these personal levels of these letters, it was about letters were related to issues in the local church. It wasn't just as it was written to some guy out here in the middle of nowhere with no ties to Christianity or very few. It was believers that were actively involved in local churches. So this idea, again, people, they when they're hostile, they don't want to admit that they're negative and hostile. So they come across, in some cases, as nice and, oh, I've got my theological ducks in a row. No, you don't. Don't think I'm fooled. Now, you may be able to fool numbskull believers, but you can't fool me. I've been around the block. As my mom always told me, never take candy from a stranger unless they offer you a ride. And having been around the block a time or two, I've seen it. And I've seen theologically what's out there. And I've seen these people that think they're just okay with God, when in fact they're so maladjusted, it's not even funny. And they don't want to deal with this. Well, again, some people, they're fine to just go off and do their own little thing. Others have to actively undermine the truth. They can't help it. They're just of that mindset for whatever reason. They've got that particular form of evil down. I'm not just going to accept the truth. I'm going to fight against it. And that also obviously sometimes means taking on the person who is the representative. This is why poor Moses, anytime you're in any kind of spiritual leadership, you're going to be the lightning rod. You're going to be the thing that's going to attract a lot of the objections and a lot of the negative volition and the hostility. Because obviously you're the one speaking most often for it. So, again, these people imputed theological positions to him. He didn't believe. And there's many people out there, again, willing to impute such false inferences to those that teach the truth. Again, we can be accused of being overly grace-oriented. I've tried to balance that with the fact that we have to be righteous. We can't just be gracious. Righteousness and grace have to work together. You can't have one without the other, or you become unbalanced. Grace without righteousness essentially becomes antinomianism. Do whatever you want. Righteousness without grace becomes legalism. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't want a legalistic church, and I don't want an antinomian church. You have to have both. And the emphasis of one to the exclusion of the other has been bad for Christendom. Whichever one they went with, whether it was, quote, righteousness and became legalists, or it was grace and they became, you know, just anything goes at our church. Well, we're just so oriented. Well, that was the Corinthians, and Paul writes them in no uncertain terms some pretty scathing words. He said, you idiots wouldn't deal with this. You're rejoicing when you should be upset. Oh, but see, the Corinthians, see how grace-oriented we are? This guy's allowed to have an affair and still come to class. Oh, really? But Paul said no. And again, whether he ever married the woman or not, we don't know. We're not told. We're just told that it was an illicit relationship. And Paul moved to toss the guy. Then Paul said, get him out. Well, for 28 here, back to our stuff here. The flow of the thought is interrupted by a parenthesis in verse 8, which begins with the first conjunction, kathos, and extends to the infinitive of the verb lego, to say. So when you get into verse 8, and not the first kathos is just as or even as, and that's why, as you see in the New American Standard, it's set in parenthesis, or it should be, that it's parenthetical. And why not say, the actual why not say is not completed until the quote, let us do good, that evil may come. So he attributes here his detractors and puts all that in a parenthesis. Well, 29, Paul's detractors were first guilty of slandering and maligning him, as seen in the use of the verb blasphemeo, which means to speak in a way that is designed to demean, denigrate, or defame another. And in 30, the second statement about these detractors is that they make assertions about Paul's positions. Again, these are the two attacks as a communicator you're going to endure. They're going to attack you personally, and then they're going to impute to you things you said that you never said, nor that you believe or not. But it doesn't matter to them. They'll impute some false position to you and say, well, we know he believes this. How do you know what he believes? Unless you go ask him and get it articulated, you don't. So again, they make assertions about his positions. This is seen in the use of the verb phemi, which means to declare or even dogmatically affirm. Matthew, for instance, it's used, Matthew 4:7. Jesus said to him, and the said there actually just sounds, it's like like it's Lego or some simple verb of communication, but you actually have the verb here, phemi. And the idea here is he dogmatically asserted to him. He states it as a fact that's not controvertible. Here it means to declare something. Jesus declared to the devil. And to say it in pretty strong terms. It's also seen in 8:8. But the servant, the centurion, here you got phemi. Affirmed, declared, dogmatically made it plain. I mean, he wasn't unclear on this when he talked to Jesus. He was very clear on what he was getting at. Lord, I am not worthy for you to come under my roof. And I say this in the most serious of tones, in the most serious of ways. You're far beyond anything I'm worthy to be dealing with. So you just say the word and my servant will be healed. So again, this means to declare or to dogmatically affirm. 31, the content of their assertions is found in the infinitive of the verb lego, to say. Which is coupled with the accusative of general reference. The accusative just that functions as the subject of the infinitive in the Greek. The sense of it is that they assert, or they dogmatically affirm, that we say such and such. And we, as Paul's trying to point out here, we don't say these things. Haven't said these things. Not that that's going to stop them or slow them down. Again, certain people, you're just not going to get in their way. They're going to fight the truth to the very end. Okay, well, our time is gone. Let's stop there, and we will continue on here with this. You will get some new notes, and there will be, I can't remember now, 3 or 4 doctrines at least that I know of coming down the pike. So you should have the one on the Mosaic Law. That one comes up first, and we will deal with that when we get. But I think that's after the first 20 pages of notes, so that one's sometime down. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this time together. We pray that God the Holy Spirit would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.